Now, reading from Genesis chapter 1, I'll begin in verse 24. I'll read through chapter 2, verse 4. So follow along, if you will, or give ear to these words. God said, "Let the earth produce every kind of living thing, livestock, crawling things, and wildlife." And that's what happened. God made every kind of wildlife, every kind of livestock, and every kind of creature that crawls on the ground. God saw how good it was, and then God said, "Let us make humanity in our image, to resemble us, so that they can take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and the crawling things on the earth." So God created humanity in God's own image. In the divine image, God created them, male and female. God created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and master it. Take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and everything crawling on the ground." Then God said, "I now give to you all the plants on the earth that yield seeds, and all the trees whose fruit produces its seeds within it. Those will be your food. To all wildlife, to all the birds of the sky, and to every crawling thing on the ground, to everything that breathes, I give all the green grasses for food." And that's what happened. God saw everything God had made. It was supremely good. There was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Chapter 2, verse 1, "The heavens and the earth and all who live in them were completed. On the sixth day, God completed all the work that God had done, and on the seventh day, God rested from all the work that God had done. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all the work of creation. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created." Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. A clergy colleague of mine has two children who begged him to go to vacation Bible school with some of their friends at, let's just say, a more fundamental evangelical type of traditional church. And at first, my friend hesitated, he said, to give permission for them to attend, wondering what kinds of things they might be taught that just might conflict with the way he and his wife had tried to raise and teach their children. But he said after he did a bit of snooping online, I guess that's something we parents do nowadays, he said he saw that the theme for VBS, Vacation Bible School, was an outdoorsy, nature-based sounding, nebulous kind of a theme, and he thought, well, this seems harmless enough. So they dropped their children off for the first Vacation Bible School session at the church, mostly because, again, their kids had friends there and they wanted them to spend time with them. And they drew comfort also from the fact that the church's website, which it promised that all of the leaders and volunteers had passed recent background checks. They were comforted because of that, and the parents seemed nice at sign-up and registration. But after my clergy colleague and his wife got their children home following the first night of Vacation Bible School at that church, they did what smart parents do, I think, and they made a parental inquiry of sorts. "Well, what did you all learn your first time at Vacation Bible School today?" they asked, expecting an ordinary answer that was unshocking. However, they did not receive such an answer. Eager to share, the six-year-old son replied, "Dad, it was so cool. I never heard this before. But did you know that Adam and Eve were born without belly buttons?" "Yeah, it's what our teacher told us. Since they were not born, you know, but created from dirt by God, they didn't have to be attached to their mommy, so they didn't have belly buttons. Also, dinosaurs didn't really walk the earth. God made fossils and things that looked like their bones 6,000 years ago as a funny joke to keep us human beings from guessing about how God made everything and knowing too much." Vacation Bible School. My friend and his spouse hold to the fast conviction, as do I, that science and faith should be compatible and that they do not need to have a conflict with one another, and they wanted their children to know this. Needless to say, they didn't return for night number two. This type of anti-intellectualism, as evidenced in this Vacation Bible School lesson we've been discussing thus far, is actually sweeping the nation at an all-time high. It's not going the other way. It seems to find fertile soil in many church environments. And my friends, young people, once they reach the age of 18, are leaving the church, capital C, at a record pace. There are many contributing factors, but at least one-third of young adults who have left church and claim no affiliation in the last decade or so say that one of the primary factors in their decision is that they feel church is anti-science and unwilling to integrate faith and reason, especially in the sciences. Now, I tend to agree with these young people, I'll be honest. Some of the most powerfully influential people of the Christian faith have held the steadfast conviction that science and religion are absolutely compatible. If you haven't figured out, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is one of my favorites, and he said, "Science investigates, religion interprets. Science gives humanity knowledge, which is power. Religion gives humanity wisdom, which is control. Science deals mainly with facts. Religion deals mainly with values. The two are not rivals." I'm a minister, if you haven't figured that out, not a scientist. I will not attempt today to lay out Darwin's theory of evolution. I'm actually using the word evolution simply to imply a more natural unfolding events in the creative process and order of life. I'm going to provide some basic, widely accepted scientific knowledge. For me to go much further than that would be embarrassing for me, most of all, but also for you. But what I want to do is to make clear to you that it is possible to be a person of faith, to love the creation stories, notice I use plural, in Genesis, and to believe firmly in scientific knowledge. It is my conviction that all truth is God's truth, regardless of where you happen to find it. There will be review in this for many of you, but I want you to hear these facts read from the pulpit of your church. And I want you to tell someone who doesn't go to church that you heard these things at this church and that no one fainted and no one's head exploded and we didn't all convert to atheism. It matters. Here we go. The vast majority of scientists believe the following to be foundational and true, self-evident. And there is little debate among these facts because they are facts. I'm not talking about alternative facts. I'm not talking about fake news, not an opinion piece written by someone on the right or on the left, just facts, plain old vanilla documented facts. The Earth was formed 4.57 billion years ago from stardust left over from the formation of the sun. Water came to our planet with the help of comets, asteroids, and chemical reactions over the next billion years. About 540 million years ago, an explosion of multicell life forms developed, called the Cambrian explosion. Actual living, breathing dinosaurs, not jokes from God, roamed the Earth from 230 million to 65 million years ago, somewhere in there. But after a giant asteroid or asteroids struck the planet, it led to mass extinction. 2 million years ago, pre-human hominids, primates, or apes, evolved over the next 1.9 million years through a process of genetic mutation and natural selection. Now, these are just a few, okay, of the big pieces of this puzzle, these kinds of facts that the vast majority of scientists just accept as basic knowledge. And here's what I want you to know as people of faith, okay? Nowhere at any point do scientists necessarily assert in these endeavors or deny the existence of God in this process. Contrary to what many Christian extremists will lead you to believe through Christian films, through internet rants and ramblings, the Academy of Science is not at war with the Academy of Religion. If there is a war, it has been waged by religious people seeking an overly literal reading of the book of Genesis, who somehow seem to fear that science discredits the Bible. And these religious people, in my opinion, are wrong. Absolutely wrong. And what's even more ironic is that I do not believe that the people who assembled and compiled Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3 ever intended for these passages of Scripture we've come to call our creation stories to ever be interpreted literally. Now, it's one of my favorite scholars' birthdays, John Dominic Crossan's 85th birthday today, so I'll quote him here. My point, once again, is not that those ancient people told literal stories and we are now smart enough to take them symbolically, but that they told them symbolically and we are now dumb enough to take them literally. There are major problems with a literal reading of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 and 3. Existentially, it sets up a crisis if you read them overly literally. It sets up a false either-or choice. Either one chooses to believe Genesis or one chooses to believe science. I believe both. You can too. Science tells us how. Genesis tells people of faith why, not how. It's stunning to me that Christians who so often say they love their Bibles so much apparently study them the least. Even a quick, simple, cursory study of the original language of these early chapters in Genesis, which was Hebrew, will reveal some glaring problems with a literal interpretation of this. When one looks at the Hebrew names for Adam and for Eve, it should be a duh moment for any serious Christian, because Adam means, quite simply, man of the earth, and Eve simply means life bearer. This couple was never intended to be or thought of in a literal sense. They're generic names because they're generic people in the story as it was told. So when you get a little further and then you look at the word day in Hebrew, as in God made such and such on the first day, the second day, the sixth day, etc., the word day, it means age, not a 24-hour period. Their calendar, their timing, it was all different. It meant age, an open age, not a 24-hour day. What gets confusing is there's this rhythm, but it's more for poetic effect than it is for anything else. There was evening, there was morning, it was day. There was evening, there was morning, it was day. It's a literary tool. This was to establish a rhythm of the story. It was poetic imagination at work, as evidenced by the fact that God rested on the seventh day. Does God get tired? Did God need a nap, or was it about modeling a Sabbath rhythm that people should reflect upon for our own journey? It was the latter. Now, it is entirely possible that our Genesis creation stories, and you notice I've said it a few times now, stories, because we have two, not one, were doing the best they could. It is possible they were doing the best science that they could, as well as telling a story for their day. Now, you have to notice that they had a firm belief in a flat earth and what we call a three-tiered universe. The earth was what you could see, that was one tier. The underworld was below, that was the second tier, or the bottom tier. Above were the heavens, separated by this thin little dome-shaped layer over the flat earth. They called it the firmament. But I don't think these ancient people were doing science here in Genesis, even though that would have been their understanding of the science of the world and creation. I think they were doing their best to provide a spiritual backdrop, not a scientific backdrop, for why they came to be. The other reason I do not believe the authors of Genesis were trying to produce a scientific journal, but rather a spiritual journal, is because, as I've alluded to, we actually have two very different accounts of creation in these first few chapters of Genesis. Even conflicting accounts of creation in Genesis 1 and 2. Let me give you a few examples. In Genesis 2, God created humanity before vegetation. In Genesis 1, if we're following a literal order, vegetation was first. In Genesis 2, it speaks of creation occurring in one day, but in Genesis 1, it says 6 days. Now, which is it? In Genesis 1, man and woman were created in the image of God, but in Genesis 2, they're made from dust. Genesis 1 treats male and female as equals, but in Genesis 2, the female is clearly made to be subordinate to the male. And Genesis 1 ends noting human beings are very good. Genesis 2 and 3 show a universal struggle with sin and evil, and temptation. So, are we to pick favorites? Which one do we believe? If we're reading it literally, we have to choose. Why did our ancestors think both creation stories should be included in this book we call Genesis? I think it's because we need both. We need the deep theological lessons that are taught here, not so much science lessons. We need to know that God is involved in the creative process. As people of faith, we need to hear that some of our own struggles today have been around since the beginning of time. We need to be reminded that even on our worst day, humans are very good. And yet we also struggle against greed and the thirst for unchecked power, to share power equally among male and female. God knows that needs some work. We need to be reminded that there is a rhythm to life and that we should seek to find a good balance between creatively using energy and resting and reflecting. We need to find ways to work, but also to rest and to reflect upon the work of our hands, just as it is modeled in our creation story. God did it. Wow, if God needed it, we do too. We need to be reminded that God can be found in nature. As Martin Luther, not King Jr., but Martin Luther, the great church reformer, said, God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also in the trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars. We need to be reminded. That's why Genesis is there. And just as we have come to know better than a three-tiered universe with the help of scientists, we have also come to know better than to believe all of this wonderful stuff we enjoy in the beauty of creation was created in 7 24-hour literal days only 6,000 years ago. And with the help of brilliant theologians and scholars, we've also come to know better than to anthropomorphize God all the time. Now, in plain language, that's to talk about God like God is a person and give God human limitations and quirks and traits. So when you conceive of the divine as a deity separate in time and space who is only active in the world when we see unexplainable mysteries or tragedies, this creates a lot of problems theologically. As if God created the world and all that is, but only gets moved to intervene when properly motivated. I can't use that framework anymore. And I encourage you, if that's your framework, to think about some new ways of using your imagination within our tradition to conceive of all the mystery of God and creation. For me, God is the soul of the universe. God's body is the universe itself. And the animating spirit of the divine soul is found in the world itself, including churches, and people in churches, and scientists, and people in the science academy. This spirit can also be found in the arts, in music, in other creative activities, and places where people hunger and thirst for truth and for knowledge, for peace and for justice. For God is not limited to the boxes that we carefully craft for God to fit inside. We cannot put a frame around God and hold God in a box or in a church or in a wafer of bread or a cup of juice or wine. God, for me, is not simply active in the world. God is also receptive of the world. God did not create and then sit down, nor is God responsible for every tragedy, but God receives and feels all of these things in life. God is enriched by whatever is counter, original, spare, strange, fickle, freckled, swift, slow, sweet, sour, bedazzled, or dim. God thrives even in differences. God loves to shape and inspire creative order from chaos. How do I know? Genesis tells me so. It is the story of my people, and I believe we're free to critique it, to wrestle with it, to doubt it, and God is not the least bit threatened. And I can do it without pretending science is God's enemy. Quite to the contrary, science is also a gift of God, inspired by the way people of faith view the world and seek to know more. The universe is an evolving network. of interperformances inspired by the maestro we call God. Some of the performances are atomic and molecular. Some are stellar and galactic. Some are planetary and terrestrial. Some animal and plant. And some, but not all, performances are human. If there is a response to be made by people of faith who are being faithful to using the knowledge and information we have at our disposal right now, at this point in our journey, it must be to care for this earth. It must be to nurture this earth and God's creation. And so when you begin to view God as the soul of the universe, and God's body as the universe itself, and God's love as the animating spirit found in each of us and in the world itself, we must take seriously our call to care for the earth. For when we care for the earth, we are loving God at the same time. When we care for our neighbor, we are loving God at the same time. Here in the only world we call home, enlightened by the knowledge of science, inspired by the creative spirit of love stirring within us, let us be good stewards of all that we have been entrusted with. Let us usher in a new day where science is celebrated in the life of the church. For truth, all truth, belongs to God, no matter where you find it. Whether outside in the beauty of creation or inside the halls of biology wing at a university. Thanks be to God for the wonder and the beauty of creation and for our part in it. Amen.